Hey everybody, Marshall here. Real quick here, before you listen to Rish and I talk about the Sword of the Valiant, I just wanted to give you an update on the status of the Outfield Excursion episodes. Typically, this is where I would tell you that a new episode just appeared on the Patreon page. Unfortunately, recording and production of these episodes was a little bit delayed after the Sword of the Valiant. But we've already recorded a couple episodes, and we're working to get those out to you as soon as we can. But of course, those will always appear on the Patreon page before they show up here on the regular feed. So if you're interested to check out the Patreon page and see what else is out there, you can head on over to patreon.com/journeyinto and see some of the extra stuff that I've been putting up there. All right, now on to Sword of the Valiant. Welcome, one and all, to another episode of The Outfield Excursions. We got a movie for you today.
Do we really?
Well, we have a cinematic, what would you call it? An experience, a cinematic experience for y'all here today.
Okay. I think I will accept that. And I did look it up on Wikipedia, and it classifies it as a film. So I guess it is technically a movie. Tell people at least one of the titles of the movie we are going to talk about tonight.
Main title of the movie is called Sword of the Valiant.
A.K.A.
The Legend of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. It's from 1984. It's rated PG. It was directed by Stephen Weeks. Do you know anything about Stephen Weeks? Oh, by the way, my name is Marshall Latham.
Oh, hi. Nice to meet you. My name's Rish Outfield. I have a podcast. I think you have a podcast too.
We do, yes. Yeah, do you know anything about Stephen Weeks?
No, he was a British film director, and he got his start doing British horror when he was a kid. Like, he did this movie called Eye Monster, which was made by Amicus Films, which was the American-financed competitor to Hammer Films. And he did Eye Monster when he was 22. And, yeah, his career spanned from 1972... to 1984. So I don't know what happened. He would still have been a young man in 84. But yes, my guess is he made a movie called Sword of the Valiant, and that was it.
Well, I saw somewhere where this was like the second attempt that he had made at adapting this Legend of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, but I didn't have time to look further into that, if there was another movie of the same title or whatever.
Yeah, he did one in 73 called Gawain and the Green Knight, just like you said. And it starred Murray Head as Gawain. Do you know who Murray Head is?
I don't.
I get my kicks above the waistline, sunshine. Murray Head really? Is famous for singing One Night in Bangkok Makes a Hard Man Humble. And he's the brother of Anthony Head, who played Giles on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Wow.
Yeah, this movie is essentially a remake of his 1973 movie, but a much cheaper remake. And yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with canon films, but we'll pretend for a second that you're not. Just so I can tell you in case the audience doesn't know. But Canon Films was a film studio, a distribution studio, an indie studio that existed from the late 70s until, you know, the very, very, very early 90s. And they were an exploitation film studio that would make these super, super cheap, like action movies, really violent movies or fantasy movies or, you know, ripoff movies. And they were run by these two guys, Golan and Globus. And they were Israeli like financiers. And what they would do is they would find scripts that nobody else wanted to make that they could make cheaply. They would like cut out anything that was going to cost money. And they would make these movies. And they started having tremendous success in the 80s with like Death Wish sequels and American Ninja movies. And there were some sword and sorcery flicks. Breakin 2, Electric Boogaloo. Do you remember that movie?
Yes.
And then, to make a long story short, they got too big for their britches and they started to try to make real movies. And they made the Masters of the Universe movie in 1987, which cost it didn't cost the kind of money that a movie like that should have, but for Canon Films, it cost a ton. And they ran out of money about two-thirds of the way through the movie, and they went to Mattel, the owner of the Masters of the Universe toys, and said, hey, would you give us the money to complete this? Because it's going to be free advertising for your toys. And according to some sources, I'm not sure that this actually happened, but according to some sources, Golan and Globus took the money from Mattel and then never shot anything else for Masters of the Universe. They just kept the money and released Masters of the Universe as it is. And yeah, if someday maybe you and I could do an episode about Masters of the Universe, because it is and remains the greatest movie ever made. But you can tell that like the opening scene had a budget and the closing scene had a budget. And then there's about 70 minutes where they had no money at all. but Master of the Universe was supposed to be like this big hit movie that would save the company. And instead, it went nowhere. And so desperate to save their company, they bought the rights to the Superman franchise from Warner Brothers.
Oh, okay.
And made Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, saying, okay, well, but this, you know, this one's at least going to make, you know, $20-$40 million. And they made it on the cheap, the same way that they always do. And nobody went to Quest for Peace. It made no money. It was widely hated. And yeah, their company just died. They had the rights to Spider-Man that they had paid Marvel Comics for, and they kept talking about, you know, the Canon Films was going to do a Spider-Man movie, and they hired James Cameron to do the movie. James Cameron was going to write and direct a Spider-Man movie, and they paid him to write a treatment, and then Masters of the Universe happened, and Superman 4 happened. And yeah, that Spider-Man movie never happened. But that might have saved Canon Films. Except for, I don't know how you make a Spider-Man movie in the 80s. I guess you just have him not do the stuff that a Spider-Man can.
Well, they couldn't have done much worse than the 70s TV show of Spider-Man. Have you ever watched those?
I tried to multiple times as a little boy, and it was torture. It was really, really, really bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
But anyhow, yeah, that was your brief history of Canon Films. They ultimately just had to, the rights reverted back to Marvel, and Marvel sold the rights to Sony, to Columbia Pictures, and the rest is history.
Right.
Although it still took another dozen years for Columbia Pictures to make Spider-Man. But anyhow, these guys made a movie called Sword of the Valiant in 1983.
I'm probably just going to give away my critique. But yeah, this reminds me of why I was embarrassed to ever watch fantasy movies when I was a kid. It was always this type of a movie. I mean, it's kind of cool and it's kind of neat as far as, maybe not this movie, but movies like this with some of the magic stuff. But yeah, parts of it are pretty painful to watch.
I'd say the majority of it is really painful to watch. And every once in a while, there'd be a moment where I'd go, oh, this is kind of cool. This is kind of neat. But today, just today, you sent me a link. And I guess you can watch the whole thing, right? On
YouTube.
And if you don't mind, would you put the link at the bottom of the show notes in the review? And people you don't have to watch the movie, but I want you to click on the link. Because in the first 2 seconds of the movie, you get pretty much what you need to get. You get two things that are just beyond awful. And one is Sir Gawain's hair, his wig that he's wearing. You get it in the first second of the movie. And the other thing that you get is this score, this awful, cheap synthesizer score that repeats through the whole movie. It's just, you get this little tune. Can you do the tune?
The audience has already heard it at the beginning of this, so they'll know what the music sounds like.
Well, they're hearing it right now, too, if you're doing your job, because put it in right here, too. It is like the lowest rent somebody on a Casio keyboard doing their version of like the Star Wars theme. And somebody sat down and they wrote this little ditty. I mean, it's not terrible, but it's super cheap. And then they play it 1,000 times.
Yeah. And then, that opening scene, you know, the sword is being forged. And there's no real reason why he's even there at the time that the sword is being made, other than once it's done, the blacksmith kind of hands it to him and he holds on to it and makes this weird, strained pose. And then they animate the flash of light catching on the blade all the way down. Like it's supposed to be this great thing. And it's just cheesy as all get out. And then later on, he's not even a knight. He doesn't even have a sword yet. At the beginning of the movie. So I don't know what he was doing with the blacksmith and why he was holding the sword that way.
This is just something they made for the opening titles, I guess.
Yeah, must.
Another thing that Canon Films used to do, and this might go hand in hand with that, is they would go to all these film festivals internationally where all the foreign, the people that would acquire films, what do you call those people? You know, the people in their territory say, we want this movie and this movie and this movie. And they would make posters for movies that Canon had not yet made. But they would show a poster for, you know, whatever it happens to be with a bunch of nonsense titles. And the ones that got the most investors interested, the ones that got the most, oh yes, we'll take that for our territory, they would make those movies. But the rest, just nothing, you know, they wouldn't waste their time on. And they would use the money that the investors had given so that they could guarantee that movie for their territory to make that movie, which is kind of insidiously brilliant. But I thought maybe this scene with Gawain with his shirt off and a little bit of the score and a sword in his hand might have been something like that, where it's just like, okay, here is 30 seconds of Sword of the Valiant that we can show everybody. And they're like, who would like to bid on this?
Yeah, but you're right. And then and just looking at that hair, it's so ridiculous, you know. And again, that's one of those things that I would expect, you know, some cheap fantasy movie being made around this time or even a lot earlier in the 70s. You know, just this weird prince, squire kind of guy. With this moppy hair. It's obviously a wig.
Oh, so obviously. There was an exploitation actress named Sybil Danning in those days that would always be in like these TNA sword and sorcery movies. And it's her hair. she would have hair like that. But it looks so awful on this guy. Okay, do you remember the name of the actor that plays Gawain?
Miles O'Keefe.
Okay. How much Keefe is in this movie?
Miles and miles of O'Keefe.
All you have to do is say Miles O'Keefe. And yes. And I'll just keep telling that joke throughout the thing. He is not without charm, Miles O'Keefe. And I feel like, you know, he's doing the best that he can in this movie because he's just like, this is going to be my big break. The producers keep saying that this is going to be like Star Wars. And I just, I pity him because he looks like a clown the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, they dress him up in this armor. It's a couple different armor, and he just, he's, even though you can't see his hair, which is good, he still looks like a doofus, you know?
He does.
I don't know. Half the time, I was trying to figure out if, you know, I mean, I felt like I was watching, you know, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but nobody else got the joke, or they didn't realize it was a comedy, you know, kind of thing.
It's true. There are moments that feel like they're straight out of that, except for I feel like Monty Python and the Holy Grail had a bigger budget than this.
Yeah, yeah.
The only thing that flies in the face of that is all of these recognizable actors that show up, man, for like a scene in this movie. And I guess we'll talk about them later, but the marquee name, the whole reason I ever saw this movie is because the greatest living actor, Sir Sean Connery, plays the Green Knight. And he shows up at the very beginning of the movie. He shows up in like a little scene in the middle, and then he shows up toward the end of the movie. But I felt like those scenes when he was on screen, it felt like a real movie. Everything lit up. Like when he walked in, I guess because he's a movie star, and he comes in on this horse, and he's like, is there no one, no true knight among you who couldn't challenge me? And he's just got all of this regal charm to him. It's Sean Connery, for goodness sake. And I was just like, oh, wait, this is a real movie. And then he's gone. And I was like, oh, you know what? It's not a real movie. Listen to that awful synthesizer.
Yeah. And he does pull that off. You know, he's got the charisma. He's got the acting chops. And he does feel, you know, makes it feel like it's a real movie, despite the costume that they have him in, which is pretty funny to begin with.
That's true. Let's go through the story of the movie, because I'm looking forward to laughing.
All right. Well, I think I can start us off, and then I might get a little muddled. But yes, this is an Arthurian legend. So it starts off, I suppose, they never say, but I'm supposing it's in Camelot. And all these knights are gathering around for a feast. And the king shows up, and he's looking at all of his soldiers, and they're, you know, just gorging themselves or whatever. And he gets really mad and upset. So he's just kind of disgusted with them, because it's a time of peace. They're not in war, so they're kind of getting fat and lazy, I guess.
Is this the court whose knights were feared throughout Christendom? I'm bored. Bored with you all. We'll have no feasting yet. We've drowned our knighthood in too much wine. Not one drop more. Not a morsel of bread until even one of you proves that he's worthy of his spurs.
And just as he's announcing this, that's when they hear somebody arriving on horseback. And it is the Green Knight. It's Sean Connery. And he comes in, and just like you said, he pretty much challenges anybody to rise up to come against him. And he has this wager that he wants to make, that any one of them can have a strike at his head with his axe. Then if they don't manage to kill him, then he will have a strike at their head.
The sport is simple. A cut for a cut. And yours to be the first. Who's going to deal me my blow? Who's the jolly gambler to play my game? Who shall lay his pride
his prowess, his courage, on the line of my neck. Come, great knights! Champion your king!
And nobody says a word, and the king is like, yes, who will fight for me? Who will serve their king? And nobody's coming forward, and finally, Gawain jumps down from the decks and says that he'll take up the challenges. It's kind of like a David and Goliath kind of thing, where the Green Knight is like Goliath and Gawain is like David, I guess. So he says, I'll take your challenge, and the king says, you can't do that, you're not a knight. So he gets knighted right there. Sean Connery's there, and he's like, I will stand here with my net, I won't move a muscle, and I will let you strike at my head. Gawain finally gets the axe, and he succeeds in cutting off his head. But that's not all. It's not over now. That doesn't kill the Green Knight. His head rolls on the ground away from his body, and then he speaks up and says, aha, the jig is up, or I don't know what he says there, but... And then he calls his body to him and says, come to me, my body. And the body walks over and picks up the head, puts it back on his neck. And then it's, you know, you can definitely tell the special effects aren't the greatest. But I don't know, some of that's forgivable for the time, I would say. But anyway, so he puts his head back on and says, aha, now it's my turn. And... being valiant, I guess Gawain is ready to let him cut off his head. And he almost does it, but then he stops and he says, ah, I will give you a year. In a year's time, when you've grown into being a man, then you will come to me and I will have my strike at your head. And so it's all pretty good stuff, plot-wise. I mean, that's pretty good setup. And like you said, with Sean Connery there, it's a feeling... pretty good, you know, getting into the scene and what's going on and what's this going to mean for Gawain and how's this going to work. And then Gawain says, well, do I just wait around a year to be killed? He says, ah, I see. You want a way out. You want a sporting chance. So he says, oh, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a riddle. And if you can solve this riddle in a year's time before we meet, then I will not cut off your head. Do you remember what the riddle was?
I don't, but you sent it to me in an email. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, life is emptiness, gladness. Well, life is darkness, fire. Well, life is golden, sorrow. Well, life is lost, wisdom. How is that a riddle? What?
Yeah, I guess he's supposed to find the meaning of that.
Okay, I guess that's it. Maybe we think of a riddle as something where, you know, I'm describing something and what is the answer? But yes, I guess the point is, if you can explain the meaning of what he just said, then you can survive. Then I will spare your life.
Yeah. And I just realized I should have let you do that opening scene because you have all the Sean Connery chops there. But yeah, so this sets us up for the movie. But what's funny is they do refer to the riddle as the rest of the movie goes on. But really, for what happens, you really don't need to remember what the riddle is or try to figure it out yourself, because it's all pretty sporadic and random as far as where he gets the meanings from this. I think, anyway.
No, you're totally right. It's just, I mean, you're giving away the ending. The riddle means nothing.
Well, they try to make it mean something, but.
Yes, he goes out and he's going to find the answer, I guess. Did you get the impression that the Green Knight spared his life because he was young and callow and he hadn't really lived his life? And he thought, well, I'll give this boy a year in which to accrue life experience and accrue wisdom. Because, yeah, I don't know how old Gawain is supposed to be. With that hair, it's impossible to say. But it sounds like he's supposed to be a boy. like a squire or something like that, who,
right,
because he proves his valor, becomes a knight, and then he goes out and experiences life. And along the way, because of the things that he witnesses, he comes to understand the meaning of life, the meaning of this riddle.
So he leaves the kingdom, and he's given his own squire. Humphrey is his squire. And so far, I guess we have two actors, right? Sean Connery's the biggest one, but then they had Trevor Howard play the king.
And yeah, Trevor Howard brings some gravitas to it. He was a very distinguished British actor, most famous for, what was it called? Brief Encounter, that David Lean movie. I remember him in Superman as the one that goes, guilty, at the very beginning.
Right, yeah. To me, it seems strange. This is an Arthurian legend, but do they ever refer to the king as King Arthur? Do they ever establish that this is Camelot? I mean, the only reason I know it's Arthurian is because I've tried to look up, you know, the source of this, and I've learned a few things, but I don't think the movie tries to key in on that. Did you get that sense when you watched it?
No, I they never say his name, the king.
Yeah. Yeah, that just seems odd to me.
But yeah, why not say King Arthur if he's supposed to be?
Right. Or market that. You know, this is an Arthurian legend. I mean, that gets people's attention, I would think. But so now I guess he's on this quest. To dream the
impossible. Right, and he's got this young squire with him. Is he a young squire? They've got a 40-year-old squire playing a young squire.
Yeah, he's definitely older than Gawain. Do you want to recap a little bit? And I don't know, how much, we want to just hit pieces of it, or do we want to go through the whole thing in lockstep with the quote-unquote plot?
Well, it's a series of vignettes. It's like
Space Hunter.
Like, it's sort of like if someone was adapting like a Rudyard Kipling book of short stories, and then they write a bridge piece to connect all of these short stories. You know what I mean? It's just like Sir Gawain goes to this place and he has this little adventure, and then Sir Gawain goes to this place and he has a little adventure, and they're not really connected. But the first one is, I feel like he wants to go to some magical land like Brigadoon, and there's a knight that shows up barring his way. And that feels totally like Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, it does. Even the guy shows up and he's wearing a mask, and he's, the echo machine that they were using, you know, I don't know if they were trying to do a Darth Vader thing or what, but I mean, it's almost like he's a mechanical man rather than just somebody in a mask.
Who calls the Guardian of Leoness?
He doesn't seem very friendly.
I'm Sir Gawain. I seek to enter Leoness.
No man may enter Leoness, nor go back once he has sounded the great trump.
What do you expect me to do? Swim?
Be killed by the Guardian of Leoness. Like all the others.
Lioness is the name of the...
That's the name of the magical city.
But I don't think he even knew what that was, because... Let me see if I can get this right. As they were traveling, they spotted a unicorn, and they were chasing the unicorn to hunt it and kill it and eat it, I think, which is... I don't think good luck will come to anybody that does that to a unicorn. So they're out chasing that, and when they come back, there's like a big tent where the trail is, and it's full of comforts and food and all the food they could ever want. And then this woman shows up, and I don't know who she's supposed to be, if she's supposed to be Morgan Le Fay or...
I thought Connery refers to her as Morgana at some point.
Oh, does he? Okay.
I thought he did, but maybe that was just me reading between the lines and saying, oh, I bet this is Morgan Le Fay.
Yeah, it could be. I was trying to look in the cast list I'm looking at here. Oh, yes. Yeah, Morgan Le Fay is who it's supposed to be. So, but she sends them off. You must go. Oh, because she knows the first half of the riddle, and she goes, "Oh, you need to go to Lioness. Go to this place and blow this horn, and it will take you where you need to go." And then the horn actually calls the guardian of Lioness.
Okay. Sorry, yes, it's been a while since I watched this. And the thing that's the worst about it is that I was watching it and every once in a while I'd think, you know, this is kind of familiar. And by about a third of the way into the movie, I realized that I had seen this movie and that I had rented it in the 21st century, not as a little boy. I had rented it as a grown man because I saw Sean Connery on the cover and I had completely forgotten that I had ever seen it.
Huh.
And so here we are, a couple weeks after I have seen it and I've again forgotten. But you're right, Morgan Le Fay is in it and I believe she gets turned into like a giant red frog
later yes.
in the movie.
Yes, she does.
So he blows this horn, right? And it summons the Black Knight. It summons the same guy that that John Cleese played in Holy Grail. And it, even so much as like he gets mortally wounded and he says it's but a flesh wound, right?
Something like that. Yeah, it's pretty close. Yeah, it almost makes you wonder, well, which did come first? When was Monty
Oh, this
Python?
Was a decade after Holy Grail, so.
Yeah, so I don't know if they were keying off of that or what, but even the fight, you know, is not very well acted. I mean, I know that, you know, when we picture in our minds or, you know, stories in some movies talk about knights fighting, it's much more dramatic than it probably was in real life because they're wearing this heavy armor and all this stuff. But I don't know if it was the acting or the photography or what it was, but these fights seemed really badly choreographed.
Well, it seems like they didn't have in the budget the cost for making armor. So they just had to get real armor and put it on these guys. And it's so restrictive and heavy that they could barely swing their swords. And that's what we're watching.
Yeah. But yeah, so Gawain does best the Guardian. And the Guardian, instead of killing him, the Guardian says, "Can you take me to my home?" And so they go to this hidden city of Lioness. And then as soon as they get there, the Black Knight tells everybody in town to kill him, that he's a traitor or whatever. And so now he's on the run. But he has an ally in the city of Lioness.
Yes, he runs into, like, the world's most beautiful woman. And she takes like an immediate shine to Gawain. I mean, she takes more than a shine. I mean, she becomes the love interest and like at the drop of a hat, almost to the point where it feels like a fairy tale where like she's a princess that's locked in a tower. And she's like, someday a man will rescue me and I will give him my heart. We don't get that. We get the part where she gives him her heart, but it just seems to be like randomly he runs into her and it's like, oh, you'll do. And they have this tremendous love now.
After 5 minutes.
I've always known that one day you would come. I've always known that once within these walls, you would be in sore peril of your life. And I must use my ring to save you.
And then?
So she decides to protect and hide Sir Gawain, because everybody in the city is looking for him because he's a murderer. He killed the Black Knight, who I guess was the protector of this magical city. But it seems like the Black Knight turned out to be like an 80-year-old man, too.
Yeah, he was definitely older.
He was a super old guy, and so he's easily dispatched. And then it is the girl, and she has a name. Is it Linnet? But Linnet, is she the princess? She's the daughter of the queen?
I think so. Like say, it's hard to tell. They don't really explain very much. But the wife of the Black Knight I guess she's like the queen or whatever. Linnet talks her into, hey, maybe Gawain could replace the Black Knight and become the protector of Lyonesse or something like that. Is that what you got from it?
Oh, okay. So it's one of those where you have slain the protector of the city and you become the protector.
I think so.
I also remember that for no reason at all, Linnet has a ring that can make you invisible.
Yes.
And she gives it to Sir Gawain, and that sort of saves his life, right?
Yes.
We get a lot of fun scenes where swordsmen are being beaten by someone who's not there. Just like the world's cheapest special effect, invisibility.
Yes, very, what would you say, Tolkien-esque? The other thing that we forgot is that at some point his squire just wanders off, falls asleep on his horse or whatever, and wanders off. So he's not around anymore.
Sir, no longer in the film.
Yeah. Well, no, he comes back later randomly again. Oh, hey, I found you kind of thing. I'm not quite sure how far we want to go down this rabbit hole, but...
Well, yeah, I feel like the actor who played his squire got an offer to a better offer to appear in, like, you know, some West End production of Pippin. And so he's like, hey, I'm out of here. And they're like, oh, okay, well, then... his squire is gone for some scenes. And just when you're done with Pippin, come back and we'll pretend that you've been around the whole time.
Yeah. So somehow he magically disappears from, he leaves Lyonesse. He's all by himself again. And then somehow he ends up coming back. But before that, he has another encounter with the Green Knight. And I guess... Morgan Le Fay had been interfering with the Green Knight's game with Sir Gawain. She had sent him to Lyonesse too early or something like that, and now he had this magical ring that was a way to cheat the rules. And so that's when the Green Knight turns her into a frog, and then he talks to Gawain through, I don't know if it was a crystal ball or just him magically... talking to him. Do you remember that scene?
No. I remember the really... And it was a pretty neat animatronic frog. Or maybe it's just a puppet, and I'm giving them too much credit. And then we never see Morgan Le Fay again.
I think she shows up one more time.
Oh, well, I take it back.
Well, just once. I think she shows up to taunt Gawain, and then he slices at her, and it's like a ceramic frog or something like that. Which is weird. But anyway, so the Green Knight is like, you know, talking to him. He says,
now where is the brave young knight who so readily accepted my challenge?
What?
The year half over, and still no answers to my riddle.
It's impossible.
Of course it is. The more you cheat, the harder it becomes.
Cheat? What do you mean?
You're not playing my game, Gawain. You have a ring, and it does not belong to you.
But Linnet gave it to me.
He, like, blows, and then Gawain is, like, hit with a big heavy wind and gets pushed onward or whatever. So he's, you know, there's something more to the Green Knight than that we know of. But I guess where I'd kind of like to go now is to kind of talk about some of these. We talked about all these actors, all these venerated actors that are in this movie. I'd kind of like to go through them and talk about their characters rather than the plot.
Oh, the plot such as it is. Yeah, because they go to a rival kingdom, a different castle, and it's got a bunch of people we know in it.
Yeah, more than I thought. I knew Peter Cushing was in this, but... I guess I didn't realize some of the other actors were. So the one that surprised me was Ronald Lacey.
Yes. Ronald Lacey plays a prince who's like a super perverse prince. And you can tell that he's perverse because he's played by Ronald Lacey. But he's always wanting to like torture and murder and rape. But he's also got a terrible, terrible wig. Like so ghastly a wig that it looks like it looks like something out of a John Waters film or whatever, where you're just like, this is ridiculous. This is a 50-year-old guy and you guys are all calling him boy. And what's weird is his father, the king, is played by John Rhys-Davies, who is 9 years younger than Ronald Lacey. And it beggars all belief, but Lacey shines in the like two scenes that he's in as just like this really nasty, spoiled, rotten, cheating prince. At some point, I feel like he is going to have his way with Lynette.
She's mine. I claim her by right.
By right of being the Baron's son?
No. By conqueror's right. I took her. There's nothing more need be said.
Do not forget that it is I, your father's seneschal, who is in charge of all things here while he is away. She's not for you, nor for any man's touching until his return. And when he does return, it may well be that he has his own ideas of what becomes of the maiden. Tell me now, are you bold enough to cross your father?
He accidentally, or maybe she's struggling and she starts a fire and he ends up getting, like, horribly burned.
The poor guy just can't stay away from being burned, I guess.
But I was going to say, like, I don't know what you call it, like the prime minister or the head of laws or something of the kingdom that's not the king is played by Peter Cushing. And oh my gosh, Peter Cushing is awesome. Even in this like really throwaway, worthless part, it's just so neat to see Peter Cushing because he's a star. He's one of those guys where it's like, oh my gosh, look at him. I can't look away.
Yeah, and every line, he sells it really well. He kind of reminded me the way they made him look. He looks like Lord Claude Frollo.
Yes!
From the Hunchback.
Because he's got a gargantuan wig on, too, that like curls at the bottom, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. But I guess if people don't know, I mean, I think everybody listening would know who Peter Cushing is. But if you don't know who Ronald Lacey is, he's the one of the Nazis in Raiders of the Lost Ark that comes after Marion and burns his hand on the Staff of Ra or whatever.
And yeah, that scene in Raiders is so, so wonderful. I don't know if it's written as well as it's performed, but like the way that he goes, your fire is going out. And he does this awful little laugh and stuff. And she's like, no, I'll tell you everything. And he goes, yes, Fräulein, I know you will. And it's just, oh my gosh, this is the evilest dude we've ever seen. He totally steals that scene.
Yes.
Oh, he's wonderful as Tote in that movie.
Yeah, that's to go from that to this, I was kind of, I mean, he does a good job too, but his character is just so weird and strange. And he's got that wig on that it just... I had to laugh at one point, you know, when they go to a scene with John Rhys-Davies and, you know, he's the king or whatever. And he's got the whole floor in front of him is like a representation of their land. And he's got all of his soldiers planted where they should be. And he's having this little temper tantrum and knocking them down and just being the goofiest person I've ever seen. I'm just like, I can't believe these actors are doing this movie and acting these scenes as serious as they are. And it's not a comedy. It's not The Princess Bride. It's not The Holy Grail, you know, and it's just, they're giving it their all, but it's just so goofy that I just had to laugh during that scene when we first see John Rhys-Davies as the king.
Betray up there! Infantry! Father, cannon fire decimating some of the cavalry.
Father.
Advance! Not now I'm playing. Advance! And finally, I take the castle. But oh, what appalling losses. Particularly amongst our allies.
Father, I wanted to...
Not now, my son. I'm hungry.
And he's only in the one scene, right? Like he worked one day on the movie.
Yeah, I think that there's another dinner scene later on. But yeah, he's just there really short amount of time. Yeah, very, very strange. And it kind of comes to the point where, why is Gawain even there? You know, because it's all this drama going on. And I guess he's involved, but just kind of peripherally in a lot of the scenes. But he does make an enemy of Ronald Lacey, or Oswald, as his character is called.
Oswald.
But then Gawain assumes that Linnet is killed up in the tower when this fire starts, where Oswald gets burned and he thinks that they're both killed. And so he's in mourning for Linnet because they were in love for 5 minutes. And I don't know how we get from there. So he's all by himself and he's in despair and he goes to this, he's dying of starvation or whatever, I think, and then goes to this other kingdom it's the enemy of John Rhys Davies. Sir Bertilac, I think, is the name. And I don't know Bruce Lyttington. Does that name sound familiar to you? He's the actor.
No, it doesn't sound familiar to me.
But anyway, he goes to this kingdom and they take him in and give him food and everything. And all of a sudden, Linnet is there. And she's alive again. This is like the second time he's reunited with her. And they know that he has to go fight the Green Knight. So it's getting close to the end of the movie at this point. And they give him this golden armor now for him to go out and to meet the Green Knight. And he takes off. But before he can get to where the Green Knight is, Oswald comes back and he's got an army with him.
We have a score to settle!
And he's chasing Sir Gawain down. And Sir Gawain's got kind of his own army at that point too, I think. And so they fight out in the battlefield. And then Oswald comes at him with a lance. And they have their little thing. And eventually Oswald gets killed as well. And there's a really good scene there with Peter Cushing. Because Oswald's cheating. And he stops the people. He says, no, let's let this ride out. And he's not that sad that Oswald gets killed at that part. And I thought that was a pretty cool scene with Peter Cushing. But again, this is all just kind of weird stuff that's happening. And all we really care about is what's going to happen with the Green Knight.
It reminds me of when I was a boy and I'd get together with my friends and we'd have a video camera and we'd just make up whatever we were, you know, whatever movie was going on, we would just make things up. And it feels kind of like that's what's going on. It's like, what do you guys have today? And it's like, well, we have a giant red frog. And they're like, okay, maybe the Green Knight turns Morgana into a frog. I'm like, okay, let's shoot that.
Oh, and then they had a couple little people that needed parts in the movie. So there's a couple scenes where he's guided by some wizards that are little people. And
yeah, David Rappaport is one of them.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's just like, yeah, he was available for a day. And so they had him come in and do this scene that doesn't really add anything to the movie, but it pads the runtime.
Yeah, and that was another character, I think, that knew about the riddle.
Oh, okay. So he gives him a bit of the riddle. All right.
Or something. I mean, they just keep bringing up this riddle. Like, everybody knows about it except for Gawain. And they're like, oh, well, remember this or whatever. And then there's another character that we're forgetting about, and that's the friar. And he was a little bit of comic relief, but he helped Gawain, and he got captured as well. He was he helped Gawain, I think, when they were in the kingdom of Oswald, and they just kind of make fat jokes about him most of the time, because he's a typical stereotypical friar, you know, that imbibes in the wine and is portly and all that kind of thing. What can you tell us about the duel with the Green Knight, or what happens there?
So I guess a year has passed, and the Green Knight summons Gawain. Is it magically, or, well, I'm just going to say magically he summons him to, like, his stronghold, or his to some place, and says, "Well, Sir Knight, have you solved my riddle?" And he hasn't, because it's impossible to solve. It's nonsense. I guess the experiences that he's accrued, each one makes him sort of understand part of the riddle. Like,
yeah, I think Linnet's death, or when he thought she was dead, I think that helped him understand part of the riddle.
Yeah, like, where life is golden, sorrow maybe is, he was given this golden armor, but he couldn't enjoy it because Linnet had burned to death. Right? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
But he doesn't quite know what "where life is lost, wisdom" means, right? That's the last line of the riddle. And so the Green Knight says, go to one knee and let me cut your head off as we agreed. And Gawain does so. He goes down on one knee. You know, he's going to meet his death like a man, which I guess is... you know, it shows that he is a true knight, that he's brave, and that he's willing to fulfill his part of the bargain, which was, you know, you have a year to live, and then I'm going to take your head. But if I remember right, when Sean Connery swings his axe to cut off Sir Gawain's head, it meets a ribbon that Linnet gave him, and it cuts the ribbon, but it doesn't do any damage to Sir Gawain.
Yes, that is an important part. Linnet gives him this sash, and she says it will protect him.
And so then I think they do battle. Because Sir Gawain says, "Hey, no, our agreement was you would get a single swipe of your axe on my head, and you've had it. So now I am no longer beholden to you." Does that sound right?
Yes. Yep.
And so they duel.
And then it's not that long of a fight that I remember, but Gawain ends up stabbing the Green Knight and killing him. I don't remember if there are any parting words.
Well, I believe he says something, some kind of little bit of, you know, "This is what I've learned in my life." And as he's passing away, Gawain realizes that this is the meaning of the last line of the rhyme, "where life is lost, wisdom." And he says that, you know, "Oh, that's the final lance. That's the final line. That is the answer." I suppose then immediately the movie is over. I'm trying to remember, because it ends so abruptly. It's like one of those movies that you're watching at a revival house where a reel is damaged and it just jumps. And you're like, "Oh, okay, I guess the movie is over."
Well, that was one of the funniest things that my wife and I, because my wife watched it with me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, she recovered. But we just thought it was so funny how it ended. Because, I mean, the whole thing with the Green Knight was good. And, you know, they had some weird special effects when the Green Knight died, because he kind of shrunk, his head kind of shrunk, and he... mold it up or whatever.
Thank you. I'd forgotten. Because every once in a while they have this, what do you call it? Like a plastic mold of Connery's head that they made, I'm assuming, and they want to get use out of it.
Yeah, so it's like they put a vacuum inside of it or something. So it's just sucking the head in, kind of thing. So that was pretty good. But then he's finished his quest or whatever, and he's returns victorious, and he's with Linnet, and it's, you know, you think, okay, yeah, he's won, he's got the love of his life, and everything's going to be happy. And then Linnet says something like, no, I have to go back. Touch my face. Or something like that. And he touches her face and she turns into a bird and flies away. And then... psh, that's the end. Credits start coming up and we're like, what? We just sat there and laughed about that and thought, what the heck is going on? None of the movie made sense. It's like, you know, a dream or something, you know, kind of just strange things are happening.
And yes, then that terrible song plays as the end comes up once on the screen. And I forced you to see this movie. I twisted your arm somehow. Even though we haven't seen each other in years. But I watched it and I was so blown away by how awful it is. But every once in a while, it's not awful. That's the weird thing. If it were just awful, if it were The Room by Tommy Wiseau, then I wouldn't have made you watch it. But I wanted to talk about it. It's like, okay, well, this scene worked. And then we get three scenes in a row that don't work. And it just, yeah, it sort of reminds me of that story about Masters of the Universe running out of money. And they never finished the movie. They just released it. Because it feels like, okay, this scene and this scene, they had money. And then they ran out of money. And they're like, well, we have to finish the movie somehow. Okay. Let's do something with no other characters. And no set. And it just, yeah, it's really, really awful, except for when it isn't.
And just random stuff happening with the plot. It's like, what do we do to fill in the time between when the Green Knight leaves Sir Gawain at the beginning until the final battle at the end? And they just kind of throw whatever they can at it. And there's little pieces in there, like Lyonesse, I guess, you know, is an Arthurian legend. That's where Tristan comes from. And I don't know a lot of that backstory. The legend has it that Lyonesse sunk into the sea and it is a hidden city kind of thing. And so they have little pieces. It's like, oh, what can we take from Arthurian legend and put in here to make use of our time while we're waiting to end this movie? I did a little research and I guess there is a poem that was written in the 14th century. That is titled Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And it's roughly the same plot where the Green Knight, you know, the beginning scene is directly tied to the poem. And then, but there's no riddle in the poem, but it's more about his travels and the beasts that he fights. And there is a part where he goes to this house and meets with this Sir Bertilac, and he's a big hunter and he's going out on a hunt, and while he's gone, Gawain kind of is seduced by his wife, by Bertilac's wife, and things like that. And but Sir Bertilac ends up being the Green Knight in disguise, and there was some kind of test there as well that Gawain passes the test or something. And then they do fight at the end, and the wife of Sir Bertilac does give him a sash, a green sash similar to what we saw in the movie, that does help protect him. But I don't think he kills the Green Knight in the poem. I watched a little BBC documentary about the poem, and kind of where the guy was kind of tracking where it could have been in England, where the poem came from and stuff like that. So it is based on something real and something, and it's all supposed to be Arthurian legend and stuff. But it makes me wonder if somebody could adapt this now and really make something out of it rather than what we got in this movie. But
surely somebody has made a real movie based on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, right?
Not that I know of, but I don't know. I haven't looked too deep into that.
Well, see, I'd be curious to see the original version of
this. I would,
this.
Too.
And you know who played Oswald in that?
I don't.
It was Ronald Lacey again.
Really?
So I don't know. To me, that's just a funny bit of trivia that he played the same part a decade later, although he still would have been too old in 1973.
But he might have looked a little bit more youthful in that one. So I don't know. If, like I said, this type of a fantasy movie was the thing, kind of what gave fantasy a bad name back in the day. If you were watching a fantasy movie, it was kind of like this. Well, this is probably one of the poorest examples of it, but, you know, it wasn't Lord of the Rings or anything like that. Do you know of many fantasy movies from this time? I mean, other than Conan and stuff like that. Because that's a good example. Conan's a good example.
Well, Conan, John Milius's Conan was so successful that there were tons of ripoffs and knockoffs and movies like that. And Canon Films was responsible for making a bunch of them. And I have seen some of those. And I don't know, they're delightful because of the dumbness of them, I guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like they are dumb action movies, but not with guns, with swords. And like there were a bunch of movies called Deathstalker. And I feel like Jim Wynorski made at least one of those. And
that sounds familiar.
They're awful, but in a fun way. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I would be happy to watch more of this kind of fantasy movie. Because if you think about it, just go to Spain or go to Mongolia or go to, you know, any place that has like a desert, any place that has castles or whatever. And suddenly it's like you have you've spent a huge budget on these sets and stuff. You know, like Monty Python and the Holy Grail cost nothing to make, but they used real castles and real locations. And it feels like it's got a budget because of that. So, you know, you can shoot a fantasy movie in Romania because there's castles all over the place or whatever, and people will let you shoot there. So I think that sort of thing is fun. There was, I did look up Sir Gawain, and there was a 1991 adaptation, but it was for television. That probably means that it was quite cheap as well.
Yeah, I mean, this BBC documentary that I'd listened to, the guy that was talking about it and taking this to all these different places was a poet. And I mean, he revered this poem. It was a treasure in the legends of Arthur and this kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's to literature, I guess it's an important thing, but none of the movies, I guess, have given it the proper respect that it deserves, I guess.
Well, that's out there then. Somebody needs to pick up that gauntlet and go for it. I don't know. Do you regret having watched it? Did you shake your fist at me when this movie was over?
No, I got a kick out of it. It was pretty fun. You know, I wasn't sure because you had kind of given me a hint that sometimes it was great and sometimes it wasn't. So I kind of went in with a little bit of a eye to what was going to happen. But I got a kick out of it. You know, something I hadn't seen before. And yeah, doesn't hurt that Sean Connery's in it. Yeah, and I guess to go back to that costume at the beginning was just, I mean, people make fun of his outfit in, is it Zardo? What is it?
In Zardoz. Well, he's basically wearing a diaper in Zardoz, though.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, I agree with that. But this one was, I mean, it was, his face was bronzed and his head, you know, he had a big, big matty hair. And he was, you know, had a greenish tint to him, and he had a little crown like a deer's horns, and that was all good. But then the rest of the costume, it was like leaves pasted on cellophane. And then it had this little, not his chest, but the lower part of his chest and most of his stomach was exposed. There was a hole there in his costume. And so I don't know. It looked pretty ridiculous.
But I forgot it does have his stomach exposed for no reason.
Yeah.
It's just like one of those ridiculous outfits that you would see on a, you know, a fashion show. What do they call that? where the girls walk by and
on the runway.
On the runway, yeah, and you're like, well, no one would ever wear this because it serves no purpose, and why does it have wings, and why does it have a helmet and all that? But it is fun to see pretty people dressed up in this crazy attire. I felt like it was like that too. You can just imagine him trying on the outfit, and he's like, oh, why didn't I shine on for that last Bond movie? Oh, it's just all I would have had to do is say yes, and I wouldn't be here.
But I mean, he owns it though. I mean, anybody else would not be able to pull that off. But you know, with his swagger and his charm and everything, he pulls it off. But it is pretty ridiculous to look at when you think about it.
Yeah, it just remains to be seen who plays the Green Knight in the upcoming adaptation, the big budget adaptation of it, which probably will never happen. I was telling you the other day that I got from the library that King Arthur movie with Jude Law that came out.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so incredibly expensive and audacious and just big and wasteful. And it lost so much money that I would think nobody will make an Arthur movie or a Green Knight and Gawain movie for years to come, because they've all learned their lesson from this thing, which again is one of those movies that you kind of have to see to believe, where you're just like, really?
Well, doesn't it have rock music in it?
It had one of those scores that had like an electric guitar and stuff in it, but no, it didn't do rock music. But it had like CG monsters and stuff in it. And there were times where I felt like, are you guys trying to do an Avengers movie, but with King Arthur? And I guess in their minds, they're like, yes, this could be another Avengers movie, and we'll spin Lancelot into his own movie, and we'll spin Guinevere onto her own movie, and we'll have Merlin have his own movie. But alas, it was not to be.
Well, that's too bad. I was kind of hoping Peter Jackson would take on the Green Knight.
But see, Peter Jackson is talented enough, he could take this script and somehow make it work. Some of the terrible dialogue and the squire disappearing for big swaths of the movie. And we'd just be like, oh my gosh, I cried when Linnet burned up. And I cried when Gawain discovered that she hadn't burned up. And I cried when he gets down on his knees to have his head cut off at the end of the movie. I don't know. I guess there are some people that can do the impossible. And I think Jackson is probably one of them.
Yeah. So, yes, I enjoyed the movie on a humorous level, I guess. But I would definitely recommend this with a heavy warning.
Okay, well, thank you for indulging me in watching this. I keep doing that. I keep seeing a movie and saying, oh, Marshall has to see this. No, no room for argument. You have to see it.
Well, I made you watch Kin, so I'm not guiltless in this. But I guess that falls into what do we go for next time?
Well, we talked about various things. I mean, obviously, if I had my way, it would be Wasp Woman, you know, the 1959 classic by Roger Corman. What do you think?
Well, you know, I put it on the poll, and it's tied on the poll. And I'm going to use my podcasting privilege and say that I don't want to watch that movie.
Next. You do eventually want to watch it. You just don't want to watch it next, right?
Nope. I'm going to strike it from the list. It's going to be on the blacklist. We're not going to watch The Wasp Woman.
But, all right. Well, you know, I guess it was a long shot that we would ever get to see it. But that's sad. I did have my heart setting on eventually seeing Wasp Woman with you.
Well, I'll just say not at this time.
Okay, fair enough. So you're saying there's a chance. Okay, so what does that leave?
So that leaves Something Wicked This Way Comes. It was the movie that tied with Wasp Woman on the poll.
Okay, well, I would be happy to watch something with... I can't say the name of the movie that I would be happy to watch. But yeah, that is that readily available? Is that something...
I think it is. I think it's on Netflix. But I'll check that out and we'll look into watching that movie for the next one. If not, I went ahead and purchased the Twilight Zone the movie, because I really want to talk with you about that. I haven't seen it in a long time. I don't think you've seen it in a long time. And so I think that'd be a lot of fun to watch that movie and compare it against the original Twilight Zone episodes.
Oh, against Kick the Can and It's a Good Life and Nightmare at
20,000 Feet.
Right. Okay. Wow. That sounds like homework, man.
Yeah.
But it gives me the chance to watch Twilight Zone again.
Exactly. So, yeah.
It's kind of like, here's your homework assignment. Kiss a pretty girl. Okay.
I can do that. Yeah. So maybe we'll plan on Twilight Zone next and then Nightmare. Or keep wanting to say Nightmare on Elm Street. Something Wicked This Way Comes after that.
All right. And if we drag our feet long enough, eventually they will have made a remake of Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Maybe. So yeah, I think that's our road ahead. And they've got to be better, right, than Sword of the Valiant.
Pretty much everything is.
I don't know. Maybe that's why I'm down on Wasp Woman. After watching this one and The Kin, maybe I want to get to some movies that are a little bit higher quality than Wasp Woman.
All right. Well, yes, that challenge accepted. And as usual, to the listener, if there are movies that you would like us to review, whether they're movies that are so bad they're still pretty bad, or hidden gems out there that we may not have seen but we will love, always you can send us recommendations, you can give us comments. I dig it. And eventually, maybe we can get to them.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you can always send your suggestions to journeyintopodcast@gmail.com. You can post something on our Facebook page. It's Journey Into Podcast on Facebook, or you can on Twitter, it's @JourneyInto, and you can give us your suggestions there. Or if you're on the Patreon page, you can suggest it right there on Patreon. And if any of you who are listening to this that don't have access to the Patreon, these episodes of Outfield Excursions come out there at least, well, typically a couple months before it's aired on the regular podcast. And so you'd be able to catch it early if you're a Patreon member. There's also lots of other content that I'm putting on there. So if you'd like to join, you can go to patreon.com/journeyinto for that. Well, Rish, thanks for another engaging discussion about a movie.
Well, and thank you for editing it, because it's the least fun part of podcasting, isn't it?
It is. But I do, you know, once I get the conversation done and I can start adding in the scenes and some of the music and that kind of stuff, that's when it gets fun. So there's a grueling part of it and a kind of a fun part at the end. So.
All right. Well, thank you anyway. One of these days, you'll say, no, it was a pleasure all the way through.
Maybe. Well, sir, keep your head on. And I'll see you next time.
All right. Excursion on.
You've been playing my podcast, dear listener. Know that it is produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. Aye, but what is the meaning of it? Who can tell me? Who is the jolly listener to play my game? Who shall lay their pride, their prowess, their courage on the rules of my podcast? Come, great listeners, champion your eardrums. Oh, I see. You wish to cheat your fate. Very well. I will give you a riddle. Mark it well. For if by the time we meet again, you understand every line, this podcast will be restored to you. It has but 4 lines. Should this podcast be sold? Forbidden. Should this podcast be altered? Verboten. When this podcast is shared? Attribution. If this podcast is enjoyed? Proclamation. Now I leave you to ponder. But never fear, dear listener. If you do not find me, I will most assuredly find you. Yeah!
Might be a terrifying, monstrous creation, but in testing Gawain, he teaches the young knight a lesson in humility, one that he'll never forget. When we're young, like Gawain, we make big statements about what we're going to do in our life, what we hope to achieve, and then we have to set about trying to put those things into practice. And in that sense, I think this is a poem, I suppose, to use the cliche, about the journey of life and whether we can arrive at the destination that we... It's not just that it's a fantastic story or a wonderful piece of writing, which it is. It's because we can all see a bit of ourselves in Gawain. And so in that sense, it's a poem about the individual. And if you can write a poem about the individual that appeals to the individual, then you're going to appeal to absolutely everybody.